And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Sunday edition of Warrior Connection on Progressive Radio Network. This is Doug Rocky, your host. And as always, Progressive Radio Network is moving forward. We're providing information to make your life better. We're going to continue on with our discussions on the psychological effects of war and military operations. And this is a very, very important discussion because all the military personnel since antiquity that have gone to war, not only do they end up with the physiological injuries, that's the wounds, the illnesses, and the wound and all the other stuff that happens, but also we have all the psychological effects. Although a warrior might not have any observable wounds or injuries, the psychological effects of war can be devastating. Not going to be devastating for the individual, but it can be devastating for the family and everybody around him. So we want to continue with our discussion on this. And to help me with this tonight, hopefully we'll have all these people on. Mary, have you been able to join us?
Yes, I'm here.
Fantastic. Mary is from Military Family Speak Out. Again, current time, working with the current warriors and their families and trying to help them get through. Matthew, are you here tonight?
Hi, this is Patricia Axelrod. Matthew will not be joining us tonight. He rang me up to tell me he was ill, unfortunately, and he sends his regrets. And while Mary is there, Mary wanted to take this opportunity to talk about a demonstration that's forthcoming with Military Families Speak Out. Mary, why don't you tell us about that very briefly, if you could?
Okay, just very briefly, this came up fairly suddenly, and we learned about it on the Olympic advertising, and we learned that there's a new show that NBC has coming out entitled Stars Earn Stripes, and we have a campaign against that show, and that's Roots Action, Military Families Speak Out, Veterans for Peace, Just Foreign Policy, and what they're doing is, well, it's co-hosted by General Wesley Clark and Todd Palin, and celebrities compete in military-inspired challenges to raise funds for various veterans groups, which initially sounds like that's an okay idea, but really what they're doing is promoting war and making it look like fun. In fact, NBC sent out an outrageous promotional photo adding the words, "War is fun." And we find that an insane statement, a very offensive statement. They are promoting war. So we are out there, and it's going to happen tomorrow at NBC Studios in New York at 5 p.m. We are protesting the glorification of war. You know, war is not a game. War is hell by everybody's definition. It involves the deaths of troops as well as innocent victims. And for them to be portraying war as a game and fun is ridiculous. So what we're asking is NBC to stop treating war as a sport, and we want to support ending the war so we stop creating more veterans who will need care. And that's very briefly what that's about. We can talk about it later if we have time.
What time is that demonstration, and where is it, Mary?
It's at the NBC Studios in New York City, probably around 5 to 7 o'clock. And in just this very short time that we've learned about it, we've gotten thousands of signatures protesting the show, and we will be giving those to NBC that day.
Yeah, I think this is the first I've heard of this. One thing that you'll find, and we've always dealt with and I continue to struggle with, and all of us that are veterans and the families continue to struggle with, is whether it's NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, or any of the news shows or any of the network television, there is absolutely no discussion on television about the actual numbers of casualties we have, the confirmed diagnoses that everybody has by the Department of Veteran Affairs or Department of Defense, and the total lack or inadequate medical care that's being provided to the families, and more important, the psychological support that we should all be receiving dealing with the reality of war. And again, exactly what you're saying, Mary, I mean, that war is pure nightmare. And when you go through it, no matter what happens, you come back changed forever. And I think this is totally evident in what's happening. Kevin, have you been able to join us this evening?
Yes, I have.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Kevin. And
Kevin, can you give us your last name, please?
Well, I don't think that's important right now. I think what's important right now, Kevin is a father of a warrior that suffered horribly as a consequence of his duty in the current wars. And the family, Kevin and his family, and all the things that they have experienced and what I've read and the conversations I have, it really, really emphasizes exactly why Mary is saying that we can't glorify war. We can't come up and try and make war look like it's fun. One of the horrible things that I've had in all my experience since I first enlisted in the 1960s up and continued on with the military through the current time is with the advent of computers and everything, the guys have gone on, they get on the computer games. There's some great computer games that the military distributes to the kids to use, you know, all the way down to grade school kids. And when they go through there and play these war games, they get the idea that all they have to do is push reset or return the computer back off and turn it back on, and all of a sudden everybody comes back again, and everybody comes back healthy. And as we know from the devastation, we know from our actual experience, that's not what happens. Kevin, if you don't mind, I'm glad you've joined us, and I want to thank you very, very much. Could you just tell your story a little bit for all of us to understand what is happening, how your family has been affected, and what you would suggest we can do and how we could do things, please, sir?
Well, first of all, let me tell you about Jeffrey. He enlisted back in 1999 as a U.S. Marine reservist, and he was assigned down to Parris Island. This was a very huge surprise to us. We had never really discussed it beforehand, and when he was going through the recruitment, we urged him to be careful and talk with us before he would sign, but he failed to do that. So after he went through basic training, he was assigned over to Fort Nathan Hale in New Haven, Connecticut. And that was about 85 miles away, so he had a 170-mile round trip during his month's duty that he would have to go down there once a month. When September 11th happened, I remember that very vividly because Jeff, who had been over at his girlfriend's, came over to the house, and he just looked at us and said, "This doesn't look good." And so from that point on, he was waiting to be activated almost on an immediate basis to go down to New York City for rescue and recovery. But they didn't get activated until January of 2003. He was then deployed over to Kuwait, participated in the evasion, and he was there only for a short time. He came back over to New Haven, Connecticut on July 13th, 2003. He looked wonderful. We had received some letters from him that said that he had done immoral things. He had done things that he only thought existed in movies. And he stated that he would never want to fight in a war again.
How old was he at this time, sir?
Excuse me?
How old was Kevin at this time?
Jeff, at this point, was 22 years old. He had just turned 22 the day before the war broke out. So he celebrated his 22nd birthday in Kuwait. So when he got off the bus, he was physically unscathed. He looked good, had lost some weight. It was wonderful, and he had a huge smile on his face. And so the Marines had told us, be very careful when they come back because they have to go through a period of readjustment. We did notice that Jeff was drinking more than he usually would, and he was very, very quiet. Some people asked him about the war. In fact, his sister asked him about the war as soon as he got off the bus, and he just waved her off. He never really spoke about it. The first incident that really caused concern for us was on December 24th, 2003. Jeff declined to come with us over to his grandparents, and so we told him we would be over there only for a couple hours and come back. His sister, Debbie, his youngest sister, came back, and found him in the kitchen with tears streaming down his face and just drinking. He was drunk. And he took off his dog tags, and he told his sister that he was nothing more than a murderer. And he tossed the dog tags at his sister. We didn't know at the time the significance of the dog tags, but he had his dog tags on it, but then he had two strange dog tags, and we found out that these were men that he felt he personally was responsible for their deaths. So Debbie called us. We came home. He was fine the very next day. In fact, by the time we got home, he appeared to be fine. And then it was on March 18th of 2004 that all the symptoms exploded. It was his birthday. It was the day before the anniversary of the war, and there was school vacation. He was in college at this time. And it was just a spiraling, twisting hell that he started going through, and regretfully, we adapted to it. And he just plunged into a lot of different things, drinking. He wasn't sleeping. We found out later he was hallucinating visually, tactily, audially. He was looking for spider camels in his bedroom, and he had a flashlight underneath his bed. We tried and begged him to go and get help, but he was afraid that if he went to get help, he would destroy his future, both in the reserve, but also civilian, because he had applied to become a Massachusetts state trooper.
I think that is
what happened is that we finally enlisted the help of a psychologist that we knew, and he started working with Jeff. In fact, his first visit with Jeff was on May 10th. And we were all encouraging him to get to the VA. I called up the VA anonymously, and they told us that his unit would never be notified unless Jeff gave written permission. So finally, on May 28th, Friday evening, I took Jeff over to the VA with his girlfriend. Jeff would not voluntarily go in, and so what happened, we had to involuntarily commit him. He spent 3.5 days there, and we, being as naive as we were when the VA discharged him, we felt that, well, whatever the situation was, we must have overreacted. We found out that he was discharged when Jeff called and said to pick him up, and there was no meeting with us. Nothing took place. And what was irritating about that was after Jeff died, we found out that during that 3.5 days, he had disclosed to them three plans to kill himself, and that he bought a hose in order to do it. And none of this information was shared. So he was back 2 days, and then he got involved in a single car accident, and he was unscathed. The police brought him over. The family car was totaled. And then on June 5th of 2004, he was supposed to be graduating with his sister, and he couldn't. And the community college he went to, they were fantastic. They were willing to work with him during the summer so he could go on to UMass. But Jeff did attend his sister's graduation, and what happened was that he actually broke into the line to give his sister a hug, and he was telling her he was so proud. But that day he became very despondent. We drove him back up to the VA, and we pleaded with VA, even his grandfather did, to take him back. But Jeff was a smart boy. He knew what he shouldn't say, and they never called a doctor to evaluate him. So therefore, he came back home. During the week after, there was some difficulties, but things seemed to be stabilizing. In fact, Jeff had even stopped drinking. And we found him going through a book I had ordered on PTSD, and he was saying that he felt that he was going crazy, and he was going down through all the symptoms and saying he had that. he finally made the commitment to go and get more help. My wife called the VA because I was furious and I would not even acknowledge them. And she stated to them that she watched our son slowly die before us. Can't they do something? Well, somebody mentioned the vet centers, which we had never heard of, and so it took us 3 days to get an appointment with the vet center. We went there on Friday, June 18th, and Jeff asked me to come in to the session with him, where I had to give most of the information because Jeff zoned out, for lack of a better word. And then they told us that they would try to see what they could do, but until they could do something, they would start coming up to the house 3 times a week to work with Jeff and the family. On Father's Day, we had gone up to Maine, but on Father's Day, we had come home, Jeff and I. We wanted his mother and his sister to stay up in Maine because they had to get away from all the stress and the tension down here. And the next day on June 21st, I had come home from work and I found Jeff raging. He was furious. He was furious at the government. He had been watching news, and he just said that there was so many lies. And then Jeff told me, he brought me downstairs and he told me how he was going to kill himself. At that point, I called the vet center. And after she got me calmed, she spoke to Jeff and got him in a better place. And but during that conversation, and it's quoted in their records, Jeff stated to her that no one cared enough to help. So later that evening, Jeff came up to me after we had watched a ball game, and he asked for the second time if he could sit in my lap and if we could rock, which we did, for about 45 minutes. We didn't say much to each other. It was in silence. So then I walked him over to his room and hugged him, and then we set up a habit of staying up because he was so restless. He wasn't getting much sleep. And after I thought that he had calmed down, I went to bed about 2, and then I had to get up early and go to work. I tried calling him a few times. And then on June 22nd of that year, 2004, I was talking with his mother as I drove into the driveway, and I saw the TV on. So I came into the house, and I was looking for Jeff, and one of the things that I noted, but I didn't really pay attention to, was for the first time, except for Christmas Eve, Jeff had taken off the dog tags and rested them on his bed. So I went outside looking for Jeff, and then when I came back inside, I happened to notice the cellar door was opened. And I went down there, and I noticed that there was a shrine of pictures. His platoon picture was in the middle of it, and it was surrounded by family pictures and pictures of friends. And then it was from the corner of my eye that I saw Jeff. I thought he was standing, but he was hanging from the beam. By the hose that he had purchased. And I went running over to him. His arm and shoulders were bloodied, and I just put him in my lap for the last time and took him down from the beam. He wrote a number of letters that were right there. One was covered in blood. And I laid him down, fixed a pillow for his head, and then went upstairs, called the police. And then his mother called, and, well, the rest is history.
Kevin, I know this is so difficult, and thank you for sharing the story. And I think from my own experience and the experience of others, what it seems, the story as you related what your son went through and what he was involved in, was far more than any young man or even any older person could handle or deal with. I think it's, from my own experience, and this is going back to relate when our fathers, my father came back from World War II and everybody else, they had a long transition period from the war. They also had some meaning involved in the war with World War I and World War II and into Korea a little bit more than we had. So there was some time for a transition that happened. But I know what happened to me personally, and Denise, have you joined us tonight? Okay, I don't know if she has. When I came back from Vietnam, I had my last combat mission, and I was sitting back home within 36 hours, 48 hours, sitting back home in my civilian clothes without any debrief or anything. I mean, we just left combat. You went, you got an airplane, you flew back. You flew back home, you got picked up at the airport, and that was it. And when Desert Storm happened, the same thing. I had to get everything cleaned up with a friendly fire. And I went to the general and said, okay, hey, we're ready to go. And he said, okay, go to the airport and leave. And it was the same thing, you know, like, well, we're all done and everything's over and just go home and there's no debriefing or anything. The horrific part about this stuff and what we continue to have, and I had this experience with a guy that just came back in the last couple of weeks here in our own town, the debriefing or the post-deployment physical assessment for physiological and psychological stuff just didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
Kevin, you're now working with Military Families Speak Out, you and your wife. Is that right?
Oh, yes. We Nancy Lesson and Charlie Richardson stumbled upon us a few weeks after our son's death. And we have since become very active in Military Family Speak Out.
And you don't feel ashamed of your son in any way, shape, or form, or ashamed to give your last name for that matter, is that right?
Oh, definitely. We have gone public with his story. In fact, one of the things that we found out that was very interesting was for the first couple of years after Jeff died, we had a number of foreign reporters coming over and making documentaries about this. And they were sharing with us their own problems in their countries with PTSD, suicide, substance abuse, homelessness. So it was, we've been very active. In fact, Military Family Speak Out has been our main lifeline mm-hmm. that have kept us going all these years.
Mm-hmm. Mary,
and
could you?
Did the VA obviously were aware of Jeffrey's death. What did they say to you, or what did you say to them following his death?
Well, the day after Jeffrey died, one of the psychiatrists called us at home and spoke to my wife, Jeff's mom, and stated that they did everything that legally they had to do, which infuriated us. From that point on, we did go up to the VA. They only gave us a very small portion of his records. And then I had asked for, under the Freedom of Information Act, all his records due to the fact that I was power of attorney and the executor, and the VA claimed a Freedom of Information Act exemption. And at that point, I remember sending them a letter saying that they were not going to handle us like they handled my son. And so with the help of Attorney Cristobal Bonifaz, we sued the VA and regretfully the U.S. government for our wrongful death.
And?
And that suit was settled out of court. I think it was maybe a year and a half after the suit was filed. And one of the things that we demanded was that there be a letter of accepting responsibility and of apology. That's all that, had they done that at the very beginning, that suit would have never occurred.
Did you receive that?
Yes, we did. The U.S. attorney gave to our attorney a letter stating that Jeff's death shook the halls, not only of the local VA, but of the VA nationally, and that changes had been already undertaken, and that, you know, Jeff's death would have a meaning.
Unfortunately, and Mary Lottie, you're there, and you can speak to this, and Doug, I know we can each of us speak to this, and as a veteran advocate, I can sadly speak to this, that there have been no changes, and I'm sure you're aware of this, aren't you, Kevin?
Yes. Over the 8 years, we've been getting phone calls from throughout the nation from families who have been desperate because of their own children. And, in fact, we just received two this past year from families that are located within 100 miles of us. And we have found out that at least the VA that we have to deal with, they are still treating the veterans in a very, not in the way that they should be treated.
Cavalier and slipshod manner.
It is. Do you know that Jeff was never even diagnosed for PTSD? He was told that he would have to be free and sober for a period of 3 to 6 months before they would even bother diagnosing Jeff.
See, that's pure nonsense.
It is.
One of the hallmarks in the beginnings of PTSD, and we deal with this all the time, whether it's my own unit members or individuals that have contacted me or the work we've done over all the years, is the slipping into alcohol and both street drug abuse and prescription drug abuse. And what happens there is it's a way to try and relieve the pressure, relieve the tension, to feel better, to make it all go away. And that's been going on since I know of, since the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just recently, in the last month, where the National Academy of Sciences totally confirmed in their most recent report, and this is up from our previous show, is up on the Warrior Connection Archives Network on Progressive Radio Network, where we have the National Academy of Sciences confirming, as we know from our own personal experience, the warrior that does go for help or wants to get the help, again, that thing that you, Kevin, that you just mentioned so well, Kevin, that your son was afraid. We had a general down at Fort Bliss in Texas literally chastise, you know, a family, an individual, you know, committed suicide or talked about suicide to make it horrific. And the attitude within the military is that if you go for help, you're weak. And the attitude within the military is, and this is hard to understand if you're not in military, is the John Wayne hoo-ha factor, the Rambo stuff. In other words, you just tough it out and you make it through and you make it happen. This is what happens to everybody. And this goes back to, again, what we're trying to do and what Mary, and Mary, you're so right on this, I mean, where they're saying that war is fun or making glorifying war, make it look like it's good. What I've found from my own personal experience with the VA in the PTSD care and treatment is they don't want to discuss. I mean, I had the doctor tell me he absolutely did not want to discuss the ethics and morality of the war. Only thing he was there was to prescribe drugs and medications and everything. And we know from our conversations with many, many people and the stuff that's coming out that the medications that they're prescribing for the individuals do have horrific side effects, and in some cases they do actually lead to or stimulate the suicidal tendencies, or it has happened. So we're running into all of these horrific, horrific problems. I wish there was an easy way out. Mary, would the military family speak out? What type of support networks do you have or information do you have available to get to the individuals? Because I guarantee you the American Legion and the VFW aren't helping. I mean, let me tell you, that we need to understand that flat out. And we need to understand also that the VA, when you try to get an appointment, you're lucky if you get an appointment within a couple months, 2 or 3 months, and then if you get an appointment and you have one, you might wait 2 or 3 months, 4 months to get another one.
And I might interject that there has been litigation brought against the VA for their failure to provide adequate care for PTSD. And in fact, the litigation went against the VA, and yet to this day, their treatment of veterans suffering from PTSD is still leading our soldiers to suicide, our veterans to suicide. So what is the answer to all of this? Mary and Kevin, please do speak up.
Well, the statistics that we recently saw for the first half of this year was that in the first 155 days of this year, 2012, there was 154 suicides.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only among active duty.
Mm-hmm.
They say for University of Chicago, and through one of the medical research, they have come up with, for every one person killed on the battlefield, there have been 25 suicides.
Mm.
And for every completed suicides, and this is another research study, they say for every one completed suicide, there is at least five who attempt suicide. That is, to us, it's a tremendous scandal of this war that hasn't really been talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you look at the numbers of phone calls to the VA's crisis hotline, you will see, I think it's way over 500,000 people have reached out to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they claim that they have saved over 100,000. I'm not sure what the exact number is. So right now we have a huge crisis on our hands.
Mary, I hear you.
Yeah, you know, that's what is so horrible and so frustrating about all of this. Everything that he has said, and my son, who is active duty now, it's our worst nightmare. And getting someone to listen and to understand. I am so tired of people saying, we love our troops, we support our troops. But that basically is as far as it goes. I went to D.C. I met with senators and congressmen, most of them have very little knowledge about the war because it's only 1% who serve, so, and nobody's bugging them about it, so they're not very well educated. And then when they say stuff like, you know, there are heroes and all of this, and they ignore the issues of suicide, they ignore the issues of PTSD, it is their duty as congresspeople to oversight the military to be sure that they are handling these things well and appropriately, and they have totally shirked that responsibility. They don't want to know about it, they don't want to hear about it, they will just continually fund war, hurting our men and women over and over again, and, you know, And unfortunately, this is why these programs are so important, because when these deaths and these suicides happen, the men and women who serve beside them never forget, and the families never forget, and they are in real pain and real suffering, and they are screaming for help, and they are not getting it. And I'm telling you, this, I hear that, and it breaks my heart. I know when my son's group came back just recently, they're only home 2 and 3 months, and they are already having suicide watch, people who have tried to commit suicide, people who are already in jail. They've only been back 2 or 3 months. But again, these men, this infantry, so in this case it's all men, are being sent back for the second and third and fourth time. You know, as a human being, you can only take so much. And it insults me that the American people will not stand up and defend our troops when they see these things happening. They want to forget it. And it insults me more that the generals don't put their foot down saying, these are our men, we need to take care of them, and keep sending them back, and Congress refuses to do their duty to make sure things are handled right with our military. So all this talk about how we honor and protect them is just baloney, and I'm so sick of people not standing up for our troops so we can stop this insanity. And that's another reason why this show drives me crazy. You know, it's a way of making war sound like fun and to let it continue so military contractors can keep making billions. To heck with how it's hurting families and how it's hurting our military. It is the most frustrating thing I've experienced. I've been involved in this for about 8 years, and it doesn't get any better. And the only way I can think of to help him and his family and so many people are suffering is to keep speaking out and keep reaching out to each other. That is what Military Family Speak Out does well, is they're very supportive so that we can have strength together to keep pushing forward to try to bring justice as the Lucys have done for their son. It's so hard when you're suffering so much, but his bravery and his family's bravery bringing this out is what we need. And so that's, you know, basically how I feel about it.
Can I ask you to give a contact telephone number, please, dear, for those who are listening and might like to reach out to you and to speak with you? And, Kevin, Lucy, if you could as well, I think that would be very important.
Well, we have a website. It's www.mfso.org, and there is a main number there you can call, but you can also reach me, and the best number for me would be gimom86@gmail.com. Is that what there is? Yeah, gmail.com. That's where you can reach me the best, and I can, you know, either via email or we can talk, whatever you feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think it's important to understand, and again, Mary, what you just said is totally clear, right on the money. Personally, professionally, I totally agree everything you just said. And Kevin, again, the same thing. One of the things that I found from personal or firsthand experience now of going through from Vietnam to Desert Storm, involved in all this stuff, we sent everybody to war this time, go around, Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom. And again, it was based on September 11, 2001, or that's what the claim was. The reason for going into Afghanistan, again, was to get rid of Al-Qaeda and everything else, and the Taliban was actually the legitimate government in there. And I think the problem all the soldiers are getting into is they get over there sent to do this stuff. They've been fed so many lies and everything, and then they get the realization. The invasion for Afghanistan, and everybody who's listening will put this up on the website, you can verify it through the documentation, came from a congressional discussion and directive from February 12th of 1998, where we were ordered to overthrow the Taliban in order to allow UNICAL to construct the pipeline from the inner Soviet republics down through Afghanistan, through Pakistan, on out. And so that what was happening. And also, the same time, pipeline was going to go through Georgia, and that was where all the battles there. What we do know happened in Iraq, and again, this was the lead up to going into what they call Operation Iraqi Freedom. The claim was that Iraq possessed chemical and biological weapons, and they were ready to use them, and so therefore we had to go in and get rid of them. Well, prior to Operation Desert Storm, they absolutely had chemical and biological weapons. They did use them during Desert Storm because the U.S. Army gave it to them, absolutely gave it to them. That's the reason anthrax vaccine is necessary, because the U.S. Army gave Iraq weaponized anthrax, thus requiring us to give the immunization because we knew they had it because we gave them the weapons.
Wow.
But they didn't have any of this stuff. So in December of 1990, again, you can verify this, and this is from my firsthand experience because I was involved. If you go to General Schwarzkopf's autobiography on page 390 of It Doesn't Take a Hero, you can verify we made the decision to destroy all of Iraq's chemical and biological stockpiles in place in December 1990, and we did. So there was nothing left by 1993 and 94 at all. And so all of this was a ruse. So now what we're having, and this is where, again, from firsthand experience, and again, I think it's very important, like you said, Mary, to bring this out in the open. The soldiers have been lied to and told that these nations pose an absolute threat to the United States, both Afghanistan and Iraq, and then the same thing with Somalia and the Balkans. There's absolutely no threat whatsoever. They have no military, no chem, no bio, or anything where they could do any threat to us. They couldn't suspend our government, couldn't take care of our rights or anything. So the problem we're running into, and this is personal, first-hand experience, we're going in there and realizing, my God, we were lied to. Now we've been involved in killing, destroying, thoroughly contaminate air, water, and soil. We have over 1 million, I'm going to repeat, ladies and gentlemen, over 1 million confirmed United States military casualties already seeking care or in care with the Department of Veteran Affairs from Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. And the VA is projecting 1.4 million disease and non-battle injury casualties from OIF and OEF and now what's known as Operation New Dawn within the year. So we're looking at 60 to 70% of all individuals now becoming casualties. Now, the casualties we're dealing with, and this is what's driving everything, are not what we would call combat casualties. They're not wounded in action. They're not killed in action. They're becoming ill because of horrific toxic exposures, and then the psychological problems of the realization of the left half, the right half, the brain. Our kids, everybody, the military, again, we have the basic Judeo-Christian rightness, correctness in our lives. And when you find out that, my God, what we're doing is wrong, and everybody, nobody wants to talk about it, it's as if we have to totally avoid this. And this is where, Kevin, where you mentioned this, and I've had this over and over and over again, the individuals do not want to go for care because they're afraid that once they go for care within their unit, they'll never get promoted again, and that's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they want to try and get a job, say, for example, in your son's case, he wanted to become a state police officer, all this stuff would be marked. And when the VA says it's not going to be out or the information's not getting it out, well, that's wrong. That's just wrong. So we have this horrific thing, the glorification of war, the reasons for war, which are what the soldiers are told. When my son got deployed, he was on his sixth deployment when he didn't enlist, and they had to bring him back. But he ended up with a 40% disability after five deployments. The information we were getting from the commander as he was being deployed was nonsense. Nonsense in order to justify what was going on. And then when we asked for the post-deployment physical assessment, completion of that each time they came back, you couldn't get it. And I know personally from first-hand experience, because in my case, it wasn't done. And I got a letter from the VA the other day denying me care because there's no evidence of the problems, and that's because the post-deployment physical was not done. So the kids are having these horrific problems, and then as Mary, as you said so rightfully, we get the red, white, and blue flag waving, we support the troops, but there's no support at all. I mean, that is a horrific problem. For me, it's an emotional, stressful period because I was involved in writing the battle invasion plans and all the other stuff.
Doug?
And then I see what has happened and how it was justified, and these poor kids are in this limbo. And as you so related, Kevin, your son was involved in things, experienced things that beyond comprehension for any of us unless you've been there.
Doug,
and then he had the
me?
Crisis within his mind. How do I justify this ethically and morally?
What did you need to say, Mary? I heard both of you say something.
It was Denise that I wanted to bring up two important things before we get to the end.
Denise, is that you? Speak up.
That's Denise.
And one of them is that what can happen and is currently happening, at least in New Mexico, is the governor there has announced a new state effort to provide free counseling and therapy for veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and other hotspots. This is a state program, and I want to encourage parents to get involved, get with their governors, and use this as an example one, because we have had problems with the VA meeting the need. But this provides up to a year, is what it says here, after they return. And this could be started within this next year time period, but asking behavioral health professionals to be proactive and reach out also so that they would have help from civilian mental health, which is sometimes more responsive to us. So that's a state program, and what I'm saying is that should be a new initiative to push on every governor to get done, is to get state programs started that way. The second thing I wanted to mention, which is important, is when these vets have PTSD and they come home and they may alcohol or drugs, the things they do to compensate. A lot of times if they're still active duty, be it reserves or otherwise, they may end up getting a discharge with other than honorable on their code, and that will prevent them from going to the VA. There is a way around it. If you go to the VA, and I need to get this word out to everybody, if you go to the VA and you have other than dishonorable and you're trying to get help for PTSD, you can go and ask them to apply for a review
for your situation. And they can expedite that review so that care can be provided. And that's important because we've ended up with a lot of vets with other than honorable discharge, because once they get home and they have PTSD and their alcohol, getting arrested, drugs, create a problem. And then when they turn and want to get help, they can't. But there, I want everybody to know, you go in and ask for a review, administrative policy review on that. And it will get reviewed, and a lot of people are getting through and getting their care that way. So those are two important things, I think, to get out there to look forward of what can we do. Number one, I think getting the civilians involved is a program that we should push in all 50 states. And I know New Mexico is leading the way on this one. So I encourage y'all to maybe look at that, make it a goal of your organization to get the governors in each state involved and copy the New Mexico program.
Kevin and Mary, I heard each of you in the background there when Doug was speaking, and I think you each had something to say.
I'll let Mary go first.
Oh no, I wasn't really going to say anything. I'll let you go first, and then I wanted to ask Kevin a question too. So go ahead and answer that, Kevin.
Well, I wanted to respond to what Mary was talking about, the NBC situation. My wife and I have been following that, and one of the things that I don't think NBC has ever even contemplated is that by glorifying or making this a subject of like commentary, I hope that they understand that all of us families who have suffered military suicide or veteran suicide, many of us see it from a different light, and that is they're glorifying one of the causes of suicide.
Yeah.
And not only the cause of suicide, one of the major causes, but also, I don't know, I just think it's a slap across the face to our surviving families and the loved ones.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, my son was my greatest teacher. I'm not a veteran. When he came home, I didn't know what to do.
You were in the mental health field, am I right?
Yes, I'm a therapist.
Uh-huh. And even as a therapist, you weren't able to help your son.
No, you know what happened until the evening that I put Jeff's body in my arms? I never thought for a moment that he would do what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Not until then. I thought with a parent's heart. I didn't look at my son, and I regret that every single moment of the day.
Oh.
And that's, you know, and probably for most people, and I think the experience you had there, Kevin, what we have found in my personal experience and talking with so many others over the years, and Denise has been involved in this and Patricia too, is the individual supposedly attempting to provide the therapy and they think don't understand the military, they don't understand what's going on, they don't understand the ethical, the moral dimensions, they don't understand what the soldier has been told in contrast to what he observed, in contrast to what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And so that ability to help the individual work through this stuff, it's kind of like, yee-wah, John Wayne, Rambo flags and everything else would do all the waving, but no acknowledgement of what the heck is happening. And somehow, we've got to turn the medical profession around to where they look at this serious. Now, as Denise has just mentioned, these individuals that are discharged under less than honorable conditions or whatever it is or whatever, they've got in trouble within the military. Those individuals coming back are in severe, severe problems already, and they should be getting at the top of the line for care. That's my personal and professional opinion. I guess after what this has all happened, Mary, you've been very eloquent in everything you said. How can people get involved when military families speak out? What kind of things do you see military families speaking out being able to do, given the limitations within Congress and the media?
Well, we just keep plugging away. Like I say, it's very frustrating. I think, as Kevin mentioned, I think we are a good lifeline for people because we understand, and people don't understand, and people don't want to hear about it. They don't want to hear about what your son is suffering through. They don't want to hear about what you're suffering through. They don't want to be bothered. So I think military families fills that. That's how I found military families, looking for somebody to talk to, for somebody to understand, you know, and who could relate with me. So I think it's very important. And of course, we do things like lobbying in our home states and in D.C., trying to get the word out, writing letters to editor, op-eds. You know, all these things are just small things, but it is just the constant. It seems like you have to do something. It's so wrong. People are not listening. But you can't stop. You can't let this go on. And so we do as much as we possibly can, hoping you will create more awareness, hoping you will say, people who say we support troops will actually do something about it. Like call your congressman, like to put the pressure on them and say, what are we doing there? Why are we there still 11 years later? Why are all these people suffering? Why are we suffering in this country? Because we're blowing all this money on the military. There's so much wrong here, trying to get people up and into action. And that's what has to happen. And that's what we keep trying to do. And it's highly frustrating. But I do think the support that Military Family Speak Out gives is very vital. And you can always go to the website. There is a number. And you can always contact me at gimom86@gmail.com. And the one thing I did want to ask Kevin was, after your son died, were you able to talk to his platoon and the members and to ask them maybe what he had experienced, or were they able to tell you things about your son that eased some of the pain about, you know, about what they thought about him? Were you able to do that at all?
No, that didn't really occur. And one of the reasons were that a short while after, we had the American Friends Service Committee had Eyes Wide Open,
mm-hmm.
and a veterans organization actually asked us if we would think about donating Jeffrey's uniform and his boots and pictures that were at his wake and funeral, if we would donate them to go around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, but by doing that, we got the press involved. Well, then the press started running the stories in Western Massachusetts, and then the Marines immediately announced that they were launching an investigation into the alleged war crimes. Well, first of all, we never alleged any war crimes. We only told us the stories that Jeff shared with us during the last 2 to 3 weeks of his life.
Is that too painful for you to repeat some of those stories? Or?
Well, as I alluded to, Jeffrey had his set of dog tags and then had two other dog tags on it, on his dog tags. And these are dog tags that his mother, Joyce, wears every day now,
mm-hmm.
ever since Jeff died.
Mm-hmm.
And from what Jeff shared with me and his sister, he was... we don't know where he was, but he was in Iraq, and he had two unarmed men and somebody behind him, we don't know who, told him, and I don't mean to be vulgar, but told him to pull the fucking trigger, Lucy. And we know, this is my paraphrasing it, but just what Jeff said, Jeff identified, especially with one of the young men. He was thinking, you know, is he the son of a, you know, he has a dad. Does he have children of his own? Does he have a sister? As he pulled the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke about the blood, the sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And, from what we understand, he shot both men.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Marines launched an investigation, and I have trouble with you know, parties investigating themselves, but and they found that they couldn't substantiate any of the accounts that Jeff gave.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're reaching the end of this again. I mean, it's very, very important. We need to continue this conversation at a later date. Future shows, we're going to have Kathy Kelly, who's been nominated for the Nobel Prize. We'll also have William Eckert coming up, who is a chief prosecutor for My Life in the Vietnam War. Ladies and gentlemen, please help our families. Contact Military Family Speak Out. We need to take care of our troops. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you, my guests. Thank you very much. Kevin, thank you for sharing your pain. Mary, thank you. Patricia, Denise, thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.